This is Focus West Michigan for Tuesday, July 7, 2026. I'm Joe Bilecki with your local news. An interfaith coalition united in Grand Rapids on Tuesday. They're part of a multi-state movement mobilizing clergy to protect voting rights ahead of the November election. WGVU's Dee Morrison reports.
Leaders representing Christian, Jewish, Hindu faiths, and more gathered at Fountain Street Church in Grand Rapids as part of a nationwide Faith in Us initiative, calling clergy to action.
I think it sends the message that people of faith care about the average person and that we want to stand up for the least of these among us.
Reverend Karen Fitz LaBarge is a pastor at North Kent Presbyterian Church and the president of West Michigan Clergy Action. She says the goal is to mobilize faith leaders to defend the democratic process, with events happening in 9 states, including 3 in Michigan, Detroit, Lansing, and Grand Rapids. Clergy across faith, race, and geography plan to protect voting rights through nonviolent actions, showing up at city councils and county boards. As a lead-up to the November election, they're hosting regional de-escalation and rapid response trainings and coordinating clergy presence at polls and online during elections.
This is the beginning of a movement. This is the beginning of average people standing up and say, hey, we would like more accessibility to the vote instead of less, instead of more hurdles and obstacles. We would like more people to exercise their right to vote in Michigan.
I'm Dee Morrison.
Residents in Ottawa County's Park Township will see 2 millages appear on upcoming election ballots. WGVU's David Limbaugh has the details.
On the August 4th ballot, residents in Ottawa County's Park Township will vote on a public safety millage. The proposal renews the township's dedicated public safety millage with a 0.1 mil increase over the 1.5 mils previously approved in 2022, for a total of 1.6 mils. The millage funds 911 first responders and fire safety equipment. The increase will offset cost increases for equipment like fire trucks, which have doubled in cost over the past decade. Currently, the Park Township Fire Department coordinates emergency efforts with the Ottawa County Sheriff's Office, increasing residential and commercial response times. Park Township maintains 4 full-time emergency staff members from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., with a response time of 4 to 6 minutes. If approved, the millage will continue that level of service. On the November 3rd ballot, residents will vote on a Parks and Recreation proposed millage increase of 0.1 mil, above the 0.6 mil amount approved in 2022. The increase would cover rising maintenance costs associated with the township's newest parks and expanded accessibility. More information can be found online at parktownship.org. I'm David Limbaugh.
Coming up soon, WGVU's Dee Morrison talks to a West Michigan builder about the challenges facing affordable housing construction, but first, news from around the state. Candidates in 2 of Michigan's most hotly contested statewide primary elections will debate this week. Colin Jackson has more.
The debates are for Michigan's Republican gubernatorial and Democratic U.S. Senate primaries. So far, the Republican forums have focused on candidates' alignment with President Donald Trump. But strategist Andrea Bightley notes absentee ballots are already out, and it might be time for candidates to start pivoting toward the center.
You've got to decide if you can win with Trump sitting at 35% average approval rating across the country.
On the Democratic side, the 2 remaining candidates have carved clear, moderate, and progressive lanes for themselves. Bightley doesn't see that immediately changing.
There's no benefit for either of them to start the transition. At this point,
the primary election is August 4th. I'm Colin Jackson.
A bill to guarantee adequate legal counsel to juveniles facing delinquency proceedings is on its way to the governor. We have more from Rick Pluta.
The legislation would require the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission to create a system with guarantees similar to those extended to adults facing criminal charges who may not be able to afford to pay for an attorney. Nathan Triplett of the State Bar of Michigan says the legislation would bring consistency to a system that right now is a patchwork.
If you're a kid in Marquette or a kid in Wayne County, you'll have confidence that you're going to be given access to legal counsel that will meet a minimum standard and have the representation that you need.
The bill would require the Indigent Defense Commission to have at least one attorney experienced in juvenile justice to help set the standards. The bill cleared the legislature last week with bipartisan support. I'm Rick Pluta.
Michigan State University's president Kevin Guskowitz says he's staying in East Lansing after weeks of questions about whether he would leave for Clemson. In a message to the campus community on Monday, Guskowitz said he decided to remain at MSU, a reversal after previously saying he would leave for the Clemson presidency. Some alumni say the decision brings relief, while others remain concerned about MSU's leadership and its relationship with the Board of Trustees. MSU alumnus Jim Warner says the biggest issue is the instability the university has faced in recent years.
My biggest concern was just the amount of change that's happened over the past 12, 13 years with presidents coming and going. It's not good for the university.
The Board of Trustees says Guskowitz will remain in his position with a salary of $1.5 million a year. Meanwhile, the University of Kentucky says Jay Batt is still set to become its next athletic director and CEO of Champions Blue, meaning MSU is still facing another major leadership change. Focus West Michigan is brought to you by listeners like you. To support this show and everything we do here, visit wgvunews.org and click the donate button. And for a weekly dose of news right to your inbox, sign up for the WGVU newsletter. A West Michigan builder is speaking out about affordable housing construction challenges. WGVU's Dee Morrison spoke with Sable Homes president John Bitely.
Lots and lots of little things over the years that have been stacked on top of themselves. It's like bricks. And all of a sudden, now it is the Empire State Building. We've stacked them so high that this pile has become literally over $100,000 in government regulation for every new house that's being built. And it's a lot of, shall we say, stupid money that's being wasted at a time when affordability for new housing is not happening. You know, what's one brick in a wheelbarrow? But all of a sudden, when you put a whole pallet of bricks on a wheelbarrow, it crushes it. So as a primary example that I can give you, and I'm speaking with 30 years of owning my own company in the building world, the township where I live and going on third, fourth generation in that township, starting in this industry, we had 1 acre minimums across the whole township for a house. Well, now at this point in time, there's a very small section that's still 1 acre minimums, but that's pretty much all built out in this township. And the rest of it's 2 acre minimums. There's no requirements for wells or septics that require more than an acre. It is strictly was a thing that happened over time, mostly because people wanted to slow down the growth. They thought that if they made bigger lots, it made it more expensive, and so, which it does, and that would stop people from living here. Over time, what it's done, it's used up a lot of extra land. As there's less and less land available, it just kills the affordability. Pretty simple math that if a lot will sell for $100,000, which is not uncommon in this township, to the consumer, if they could buy a 1 acre lot for $80,000, they would think it was a deal rather than paying $100,000 or $120,000 for 2 acres that they don't even need. But it's required. Didn't like that answer. The people that need houses don't live there, don't get to vote. And those that live there and already have a house don't care. That's just one item on density and lots. You know, there's other things going on, such as ADUs and small houses and tiny homes, and a lot of people roll their nose at them. Oh, they're just going to be cheap houses. It's going to cause all these problems. But it's been proven that nice communities with those intermixed or even communities of them, that it works out nicely. You can build one of these for your mother-in-law or your son or daughter to live outside of your home on the back of your lot for $125,000. Well, that's a whole lot more affordable than a $400,000 home with property. And it's a way to help solve these issues, but there's very few communities that are allowing them.
When we're talking about zoning, obviously happening at the local level, what would you like to see here?
Part of it is that those that are in charge in our local communities need to have more compassion for people that are not necessarily like them. And I'm not necessarily pushing the race button or anything like that, but it has more to do with the haves and the have-nots, or the young and upcoming haves that just don't have it yet. I proposed a development in a community about 10 years ago. And at that time, that community's average home sale price was less than $200,000. We were proposing a community of new homes that would have been, it would have been $300,000 for a home. And I had literally one of the elected board members state in a meeting that if it wasn't $500,000 homes, they didn't want them. And their average price was less than $200,000 at that time. That's very unrealistic expectations for a community. They managed to stop that with all their red tape and rigmarole and different things that took place. And now that same community has nice new schools, and the school district is going, we're in trouble because we don't have enough students to fill all these rooms and desks that they have, and their funding comes by pupil, not by the tax dollars. So if there's no kid to sit in that desk, they don't get to pay the teachers and support the school. That's the short-sightedness that's going on with these communities that don't want development. So back to your question of what do I want to see happen, I'd like to see our local governments behave themselves better, and if they don't, how could we make them accountable? Our current system, the only way to make them accountable is to recall them or don't reelect them. There's just no other accountability. The challenge has come in as the state has said, look, if the locals aren't going to let these things happen, we'll take control. Well, there's a big pushback that we like local control because we don't necessarily trust Big Brother either. And we end up in a round room with no corners, and everybody's just running round and round, and we're not getting any answers, and the problem is just continuing to magnify.
So we need a shift in mindset in local leadership when it comes to development, affordable housing.
Let's be honest. When somebody hears affordable housing, what's the first thing they think of? Most of the time they think of government subsidies, they think of crime, they think of challenging situations. Affordable housing technically is described as if you spend more than 30% of your income for housing, it's not affordable to you. So when we start talking about these $400,000 homes, people have to have an income somewhere in the $150,000 to $200,000 range to afford these.
If we're looking at, say, a teacher or a nurse, a young family, they're looking for a starter home in our area right now, what are their realistic options?
That's why the rental market's so high, because those people are being forced to rent because they cannot find livable homes in the 30% of their income price range. A number of things have happened over the years. We do not have enough starter level homes, which would be usually a smaller home. So as an example, in my career, we built a lot of homes that were designed to be reasonable to buy to begin with, and then you could expand them by finishing lower levels and so on. And they started out as a two-bedroom, one-bath home. We sold a lot of them for $119,000 in the day on one-acre or less lots. And now I can't even get a one-acre lot to build them on. But even if we do, most people build them as three and four bedrooms, and they're $300,000 or $350,000. Well, that's very tough for a young professional nurse with, even if they have only a small amount of college debt, and they still might be making $80,000, but it doesn't fit into their budget. They just can't swing that 30%. You know, we need to have ways to build them homes in the $200,000, $250,000 price range. And the communities need to recognize it's not going to hurt their house values. It's not going to bring troublemakers. It's just a place for our young professionals and young people to get started in life. Number one is they have to look at their own community, whether it's a township or a village or city, and take a look at their planning commission and their board and what the rules are and what they're doing about it. There is a number of communities that are trying to do things, and they are moving to offering methodologies for small homes or ADUs where you add a home behind. But there's also a lot of communities that want nothing to do with it. There's a number of communities that are doing things to block higher densities. Some of them are just flat admitting that they only want to be a community for the elite.
Is there anything that you would suggest you could see state or federally that would have a positive impact on the affordable housing issue?
Our society has to decide. It's easy to give lip service to affordable houses, but nobody's making the tough decisions to allow them to happen. And so far, they continue to be blocked. There's even things such as our codes, you know, the way we build houses, the requirements. You know, an example is every so often we hear about, well, everybody should have fire suppression or sprinkling in their new home. And it adds literally thousands of dollars, and especially if you have a well versus public water and some of the hidden costs that go with it. You know, it's safety and it's a concern, but there's never anything on it about existing homeowners having to add sprinkling to their house to make them safe. And everybody would be ticked off beyond belief if every homeowner was mandated to install new sprinkling in their house. But they're okay with requiring it on new homes and making them so unaffordable that nobody can afford to buy them. It's easy to say it's only a few $100, but look at the ripple effect it causes. And I go back to the brick scenario. You can put one or two bricks in a wheelbarrow and still make it move. When you put a whole skid or pallet of bricks on that wheelbarrow, it crushes it. And that's where we're at with all these regulations and codes. We've added so many bricks to that wheelbarrow, nobody can move it. Matter of fact, it's got a flat tire and it's stuck. And we've got to unload that wheelbarrow.
Thank you, John Bitely, President at Sable Homes and Sable Developing. I'm Dee Morrison.
This has been Focus West Michigan from WGVU for Tuesday, July 7, 2026. I'm Joe Bilecki. Our audio operations manager is Rick Bierling, and our news and public affairs director is Patrick Center. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll be back with more news and events in West Michigan tomorrow. Thanks for listening.